got Keen on. You hear him? He's a good interviewer. You heard him?
No, I don't think so.
He's on CNN News now. Alan Keen?
I just wanted to make sure that we're coming across. I can monitor the tape this way so that I'll just leave this off to the side from time to time. The other thing is that I will be making some notes, generally writing down names of people, and if there's an unusual name, if you could spell it for me, then when we transcribe it, we'll get it correctly. This is Jim Boning of the Center for History of Chemistry talking with Malcolm E. Pruitt on January 15, 1986, at the Willard H. Dow Center in Midland, Michigan. Dr. Pruitt, you were born on October 15 in Hamilton, Texas. Could you tell me something about your parents?
Yes, my parents' name was Jesse F. Pruitt, my father. And my mother was Maddie Noxie Stone Pruitt. And they were, we were farmers. Grew up on a farm, and they had six children. I was the second of six children. And we grew up on a farm just outside Hamilton, Texas. And had very good parents, fairly strict parents, but very good parents, a good farmer, and very Christian people. And I guess generally speaking, we weren't very rich in today's standards, but we were considered the middle or elite of the community, even though by today's standards we'd probably be in the poverty level. But we had I had a good childhood, I think. I had to do a lot of hard work, which I didn't mind. So I guess I've got nothing but pleasant memories, almost, about my childhood and my parents. They both lived till they were in their 80s.
You mentioned that you were one of six. Could you tell me something about your brothers and sisters?
Yes. My older brother was a farmer and rancher in Hamilton County. My next one was a sister who married, her name was Reese, Margaret Reese, and he was a vice president of a pharmaceutical house. Lived in Fort Worth, Texas. The next two were twins, Fay and Ray. And Ray became a school superintendent in Texas and is presently superintendent of schools in Eastland, Texas. And the sister married a fellow named Bert Schrank. That's S-C-H-R-A-N-K. Who is a Gulf oil distributor in Hamilton, Texas. And they're all living except Margaret, who died this past summer from a brain tumor. Mm.
Did you receive your early schooling in Hamilton?
Yes, I received all my high school education, elementary and high school, in Hamilton, Texas.
Were there any teachers or anyone at that time in your life that had an influence on you?
Oh, yeah. I remember well my first grade teacher, Mrs. Scoggins, who I thought was just vaguely remember, but made a good impression on me. I guess that's what made me like school from then on, I guess. I had a Schauser down us, all of us. We all had to memorize Schauser, and was an excellent English teacher. In fact, I don't know how old she is now. I think she's in her 90s, but she still makes practically every high school reunion down there. She's one swell teacher. But the one who, in relating to what we're talking about, is my high school chemistry teacher, Cecil Nix, who was also superintendent of the schools of Hamilton, but he was teaching chemistry on this one course. And he inspired me. He's the one who inspired me to decide I want to be a chemist. And we didn't have a very big class, just a few in there. And we did a lot of experiments together and a lot of talking. I liked him, and he liked me. And just in that, we didn't have too much equipment. We had to improvise a lot of it. But anyway, in that setting, that's where I decided I was going to be a chemist in my life, and never varied from it.
What about mathematics?
Yeah, I had a good mathematics teacher, a fellow named John Sullivan, who was really down-to-earth fellow, and I was very impressed with him, yeah.
When did you decide to attend Abilene Christian? Is that
I graduated from high school in 1933, right in the depths of the Depression. Couldn't have been any worse. But I was determined to go to school and take chemistry and start being a chemist. But my parents were farmers with very little money, with four children. Also, I had some cousins living in Abilene, which I could stay with. And so I stayed the two cousins and myself. We roomed a batch together in a little house. We did all our cooking and all our ironing of our shirts and everything else, you know. But I went to school, and I never took another dime from my parents after that. Not another dime. They'd offer it, but I wouldn't take it. I made my way completely from there on. But that was hard times. But, you know, I think really that says a lot of people who grew up just like I did have turned out to be pretty solid citizens because of the, you know, you had to worry about making yourself go, or you didn't, and it was good training.
What means did you use to support yourself then while you were there?
Well, of course, we had this house, and we bought and cooked our own food, and we milked our milk. We had a milk goat we got somewhere, milked that for milk, and lived on mush and little bacon and a few other things. But ironed our own clothes, washed our own clothes in a tub. But for tuition, I worked for the school, and most of the time I worked in the extension office. That's the correspondence course, you know, where they send courses out. And I ran that office, all the mailing and duplication and that stuff, and for years, tuition. Then the later years, college, I worked in the restaurant for my food. And then I stayed in a dorm some years later, and I worked in the extension office mainly for most of my tuition and my room. In fact, I actually ran that place. You know, I had an opportunity to make a fortune when I was in college because since I had the main duplicating equipment for the university, all the teachers came to me to run their final examinations. So I had privy to every final examination in the school. Boy, did I get bribes. I could have made a fortune selling those.
If I understand correctly, you were at ACU for several years, but you didn't finish.
Well, yeah, it took me 8 years to get my BS degree. I went one full year on the scholarship and everything. I went one full year. Stayed in this house with these other two boys. Okay. Then I, of course, I was completely out of money. Then I came home that summer and worked in a dry goods store, David Harlick's. David Harlick, H-A-R-E-L-I-K, David Harlick's Dry Goods Store. I worked there all that summer and all that fall, and accumulated enough money, and then I went back to the spring semester. And that got me a year and a half. Then I went back right back to Harlick's and worked summer and fall again. And then I went to another springs. I got 2 years of college. Then in that day and time, you could get a temporary teacher certificate for 2 years of college. So I got me a temporary teacher certificate, and that fall I went to teaching in the Lund Valley School in Hamilton County. L-U-N-D, Lund Valley School. And I was a teacher of the 7th and 8th grades in this small rural school. By the way, very good school, little school. And I taught that way 2 years. Well, 2 years. And see, I'm not sure I went to school the first year. No, I, in the summertime, I was probably still paying back some debts I owed. And in the summertime, I would make, you remember when they used to measure the allotment for cotton planting in this, when they first started the allotment to farmers, how much cotton and wheat and stuff they could plant. But in the summers, I, for the county, I measured the farm for the cotton allotments and other allotments in the summertime. Then the third year, I became principal of this school, of Lund Valley. And in that position, I had to teach woodworking. And I never had a woodworking tool in my life. So I switched and went to school at North Texas State, who had a woodworking. See, ACU didn't have one. So I took chemistry and woodworking, so I'd be able to teach that when I got back that fall. So I went there 3 summers, taking chemistry and physics and woodworking to be sure I could teach woodworking. And then in the summer of 41, I went back to ACU because I could get my degree quicker there, and took my final, all my final courses, which was a pretty heavy load, by the way, and particularly all the chemistry I needed extra, and graduated in the summer of 41 from ACU with a B.S. in chemistry.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about your experiences at ACU in the chemistry department, but before I do, let me ask you about North Texas State, since you took some chemistry there. Was there any, what courses did you take, and was there any faculty member that you remember?
The one I remember most was this old Dr. Masters, which probably people know, and I think he's written several textbooks. And I took from him, let's see now, let me get my marbles straight. I took from him, I think, advanced, no, I took from him organic chemistry, a course, one course in organic chemistry. But this old fellow was a, heck, he was in his 80s when he was teaching his course, and he'd stand right there and spit, you know, spit all over the people in the front seat, pedaled, you know. Very, but a very effective teacher. I was really admiring him. I took analytical and qualitative and quant both there. I took physics there. And I remember the teacher there was a visiting professor from University of Texas, but I can't remember his name. And let's see, some more courses. Let's see, one more. See, qual and quant and organic and physics. Maybe I took 2 courses in physics, probably.
Was that your first exposure to organic chemistry, that course from Masters?
No, no. See, I think I said advanced. I don't know whether it was advanced or just a different course. I took three courses in organic, I think. I took my final course in the summer of 41 from Dr. Whip. I had about three different courses in organic, and maybe they had a different name, but they were, might have been one of them been theory of something. I can't, frankly, I don't even remember now.
You mentioned Dr. Webb. Let's go back then to ACU.
The best teacher I ever had, Dr. Webb, Abilene Christian University. He was the prime teacher. They didn't have two or three teachers. The whole thing was in a little wooden shack. They called it the shack. It had a couple of classrooms and some crude laboratories. And Dr. Whip is one of the finest teachers I ever run into. Unbelievable. Simple and down to earth, but man, did he know organic, or chemistry generally, but organic in particular, with a little leaning toward biochemistry. In fact, Dr. Whip, it is said, got his PhD from the University of Colorado and discovered sulfur drugs on it, but too late to get credit. Other people got, was somebody in England?
Mm-hmm.
Got credit for it, but he had discovered the same thing on his own.
Did you do any research as an undergraduate?
Not really, no. We didn't have, we just did the experiments. Not really. Or we'd be assigned problems to do, but you know, that's not research, I don't think. More just solving a problem. So it was mostly just testing and problem solving.
Were there any other students there that you remember that went on to careers in chemistry the time you were at ACU?
No, I don't think there's anybody. Well, there was one person who was in the chemistry department, something off and on, that worked for Dow, and Sanford Thompson, who worked for Dow as a chemist, but he got more involved later into other things like safety and inventory and stuff like that. But yeah, he was in my case. I don't know of any of the others went to school with me that did great things or anything in chemistry. I think most of them was just taking it and never made a career out of it, I don't believe.
Had you heard anything about polymers before you left ACU?
No. Oh, probably might have heard the word somewhere in a textbook. I knew nothing about polymers when I went to work for Dow. Hardly knew what the word meant.
Well, when you left ACU, did you teach yet one more year?
Yeah. I got my degree then in 1941, and I didn't know of any place to try to go for a chemist job, and I was really in debt, man, you know, trying to work my way through all this, still hard times. And I got a job at Clyde, Texas then, teaching as a science teacher and assistant football coach.
Yeah.
And taught there 1 year, and this was a very pleasant experience. I really enjoyed that.
Then, of course, it was around that time that Dow was expanding in Texas. How did you make first contact with Dow?
Well, okay. Let's see. Somewhere while I was teaching, I went back home to Hamilton to visit my parents. And there was somebody there in Hamilton who told me he had read in a paper that a new chemical company was coming to Texas called Dow. and they were going to build a plant in Freeport, Texas. Well, you know, that's just a little conversation. I never heard of them. I didn't know hardly about anything about any chemical companies or anything. I didn't even know what a chemist did hardly. Anyway, I decided I was teaching in Clyde. On Christmas holidays, I was going to go out and start looking. And I decided to go first to Exxon. Now, I'll let you read that article. I should have brought that for old Jim Mathis, who was the senior vice president of technology of Exxon. I went down to Baytown, you know, Houston there, to apply for a chemist job with Esso. And they didn't really have anything, and they really were looking for a little higher degree. I just had a BS, and if they started you, you know, they started you out in the roughneck, you know, where you worked in the blocks and fields and lifted and that. But they really didn't have anything for me. So, see, that was, remember this about Dow, which is only about 70 miles, or less than that, 60 miles down the coast. So this was the middle of the afternoon, and my dad went with me. It's me and my dad traveling. So I decided to take off down to Freeport, see what the Dow had down there. I got there just before quitting time, about like 4:30, you know, and they quit at 5. So I went into the department office, and they gave me a blank to fill out, and I filled it out, went up and handed it to them, and they said, "Thank you, we'll let you know, send your job." I said, "Man, I've come too far to just hand you a blank. I want to talk to somebody." "Well, it's too close to quitting time, and I don't think we can get anybody." I said, "Well, I insist." Finally, they sent me around to the personnel director, a guy named Peters, by the way. And I sat down, and he looked my blank over, and he said, "Well, the first thing I see wrong with you, you've just taught school too long." 6 years. That was the first thing he said to me. Well, I thought, well, that's kind of a stupid remark. But anyway, he said, "Well, okay, we'll file this and put it in there and let you know." I said, "No, I want to talk to somebody that's got a job." I insisted. If I hadn't, I'd have never got a job. I'd just walked off and that'd been it. And this guy hummed and hawed around, and finally he said, "Okay, I'll call Dr. Wright." About the only thing they had in Freeport at the time was an analytical lab. And Dr. Wright, E.R. Wright, was the head of the analytical lab in the Freeport section. So he says, he'll be coming this, it was now, it was almost 5 o'clock. And he says, he'll be coming out to go home here in a few minutes, and we'll just have you meet him in the clock room, and you talk to him. I said, "Well, fine." I expect him to see, you know, big, dignified, well-dressed guy. You know, you never got all these images. Mm-hmm. Well, here come this guy in a little, Freeport's pretty warm, even in summertime. I think he had short sleeves on. He had his lunch bucket, little black lunch bucket. Come in, punch the clock like everybody else. And we sat over in a little corner there in the clock room and talked. But very nice man and very smart man. And we talked a bit. And he liked the idea about me teaching school. And he said, "Say, yeah, I think we can use you. Now we're going to open up." See, Dow put the magnesium in for Dow there to build magnesium for the planes, for the military. And then they were going 7 miles away. I don't know where you've ever been to Freeport or not. Yeah. You ought to go down there. And they were building Dow magnesium 7 miles away from the coast to get away from a submarine attack in case, you know, there was a submarine attack. And they were building a big ditch to bring the seawater up to this plant called Dow Magnesium Corporation, owned by the government. And he says, "Next summer, we're going to open that, and we're going to need some people, and we'd like to have you." I said, He said, when can you go to work? And I said, well, I can't go to work. I'm going to finish my school year. I'm not going to run off and leave them. So I'll be ready to go to work next June when school's out. He said, okay. And you mean you already got that all done?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, there's that the is.
Copies. I mean, that's the original. These are the copies. And I didn't know if you had those two.
Yeah, you see, you had this one, didn't you? The Site of Engineers.
Yes, I have that.
And wait a minute, I don't believe you may not have had this one. That was why I'm talk I made one time to...
No, I don't have this one.
Don't have this one.
These
are the copies?
Mm-hmm. This is the copies. These copies
there. Okay, let me put these down there then.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see, where was I?
You're going to go back and finish your school year. He wanted to know when you could start. And
oh, yeah. He said, okay, I'll let you know next spring, you know. Okay, June came, and I got out of school, so I went back to my parents. I was going to help him farm that summer if I didn't have anything else to do. So I was out on a tractor plowing farmland. My wife come running to the field and said, say, you got a letter from Dow offering you a job. This was June. So I went home, packed my duds, and headed for Freeport. Went to work June 24th, 1942.
What was your first position there? I have a note here, magnesium shelf dryer.
Probably the lowest position a chemist can have in the company was a control chemist on the graveyard shift, running mag. You see, what the shift guy is, they take seawater and they add lime to it to precipitate the mag hydroxide. And that's, they got big door tanks that stir, and that slush settles to the bottom. Then they pump that out and hit it with HCl. Dilute solution and make mag chloride. Then they take the mag chloride and drive off most the water in an evaporator, they call it. Then they take this semi-solid material and put it in a shelf dryer, and it's a big thing that rotates shelves, a hot air blasting up, and they dry it to about two. Well, the consistency they want for their mag cells, which is about 70% in that neighborhood. And my job was to determine when the shelf dryers, were they making the proper, see if that wasn't within a percent or so of water content, it wouldn't work in there. And so my job was to analyze Rollhard titration. You know what a roller?
Yes.
These were all wet methods. No, we don't have any of those fancy things. And roll hard titration, and that's what I did on the graveyard shift. And a lot of times, the foreman felt like he didn't pay attention to analysis. He felt like he'd go feel of it and tell you better where he's ready to go in there than I could. Then a lot of times he'd even taste it, you know. That was his method. But
how did that method compare with your analysis?
Wasn't bad. They pretty good. They pretty good. You know, they. I'll tell you, those guys. You know, some of these practical things and feel and eyesight are pretty slick. Those old boys that ran those things, it's amazing. You know how much they know about things. You know. So.
Yes, it was the next year you moved to the analytical lab then. Is that correct?
Well, this was in the this was an extension of the analytical lab. I still worked under Dr. Wright, and he ran all these labs out in the. Well, I did that in June and started training there, and then in August of the same year, I moved over to this new plant. They opened it up, which I was hired for in the first place. Now, and I set up the lab in the shelf dryer. I actually set it up and got it running to do the analytical work for the shelf drive. And this is where I ran in, first time I ran into union jurisdiction. Of course, we didn't have much in the way of laboratory, and so I needed a funnel rack. Didn't have one anywhere, so I decided I'd just build me one. So I scrapped the lumber around there, and I had me a hammer and a saw, and I was making me a funnel rack, you know. And some guy came along and tapped me on the shoulder, and he says, "You can't do that." Well, what I thought he meant, I didn't have the ability to build. I says, "The heck I can't, just watch me." Well, that was a union steward telling me that. I didn't know what a union steward was, never heard of a union. No, green as a gourd. Director of the superintendent came by and said, "Say, you just upset the union steward. You're not supposed to be doing carpenter work." I said, "I'm not. Who ever heard of such a thing, you know?" Anyway, I caused a semi-grievance right off the bat. But that was my first run-in with the union. Yeah, and then I stayed there about 2 or 3 months, and then they transferred me direct up to the main analytical lab in the Dow Magnesium Corporation, where we did all kind of analysis. You know, what we call adjusting liquors, and mag hydroxide, cell feed, lime, you know, everything that's in the plant we ran. And we had a spec lab, and we had all kind of stuff up there. So I went up there, stayed about a year, and then one day say, "We'd like to transfer you to the gas lab over at Plant A." Now, this is back to Dow Chemical. And I liked these guys so well. We played touch football. Bunch of people. And I didn't much want to leave at the time. It's kind of stupid to think about it. But anyway, I said, okay. So the next day, they shot me at the gas lab. And this is where they were analyzing. We had, by that time, built light hydrocarbon plant. Doc Wright was a very non-communicative, very reserved, very quiet, very thorough, very good. A lot of people didn't like him because he didn't communicate. He communicated in yeses. So Doc Wright undoubtedly had his eye on me to do that, but he wanted to be sure. So he came down one day at the gas lab and got me off the pod bill and said, "Say, I've got a paint VHC cloud." So I took that and identified everything in it for him, distilled it and did all kind of things. Came up and said, "Say, he had a bench up on in the main wet method lab where he did special samples, oddball samples that came in. He said, I'd like you to come up and work for me." So I'd been there 2 weeks, and one day I said to him, "Doc, am I going to stay here standing there?"
I caught him. He wasn't ready to answer me. So I was crazy. So then I, a little later, you know, we had these big slide drills where we did all our calculations. You've been through this probably in yourself somewhere. Chief chemist there.
Walked by the wall Monday morning. Got on, walked off. Didn't say another word. Well, that's good enough. That's all you need to know. So I went to work research.
Is that when you moved into the organic lab?
Yeah, when I moved in organic. Really worked directly for Bobby Wall, which are, you know, we had about four or five people then. And we started off on a polymer project. He was trying to, you know, Dow up here was doing a lot of work on vinyl vinylidene chloride polymerization to make Saran. And Bobby Wall thought he had a better idea how to do that. And I was helping him set up and do a little polymerization there, which never did mount anything. And right off, I could see that he didn't have anything. But I had to set up his equipment and do the experiments for him. And that lasted very short, and I went to something else. Bobby Wall went on to become a researcher for Monsanto. Mainly, he was very good at instruments, very good at equipment, all that kind of stuff, but wasn't too interested in carrying out the experiments. We'd set up a good, fine apparatus and all the instruments to go with it. Then he'd say, tear it down. I said, wait a minute, let's run an experiment in this thing. Well, it's not right, you know. All he was interested in, he was more physics, you know, physics. His interests were in instruments, physics, that kind of thing, not in the chemical part. And by the way, very good at it.
It's my understanding that when Dow first started in Texas, the research would be concentrated here in Midland.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We were not supposed to have any research in Texas. None whatever. That's right.
And how did that slowly change?
Well, they built a light hydrocarbon plant, and then they built a glycol plant, alkaline oxide plant, and then some glycol. And then started getting in some chlorinated solvents, and they had to have some troubleshooting. So Mr. Roush, who had hired Earl Barnes down to run the glycol plant, he up here from Midland, who was in the special training course, decided that he had put him a troubleshooting. Well, before that, this was all in the middle of the war, you know. Right, everything was in the war, and I was in and out of 2A, 1A, and then the government kept demanding, you know, you're in magnesium, you just can't leave, you know. So all of us was working on magnesium. They just wouldn't let us go, you know. So they'd get a deferment and put us back. We'd go in 1A, and he'd come right back, you know. I never knew when I was going to go, but I guess it was a pretty essential occupation. And but also, we decided to bail the government. You know, they're needing synthetic rubber real bad, and special rubbers, particularly for gaskets and things. And this thiokol rubber all of a sudden became very important to the government, and they wanted Dow to bail the thiokol rubber plant. So they pulled Earl Barnes off to start the building and the running of a thiokol plant. And we got this thing built and was training people and everything. Then they decided they didn't want it, so we never did start it up. Then about that time, Mr. Roush, who was the general manager of production, decided he needed a troubleshooting group. So he said, Earl, you set up a troubleshooting research group. And nobody, I don't think, had any trouble. They could see that needed to be done, but no real research, just plant problems. But we very quickly started moving into research. And you see, we got no research money from Midland. The money, it all came out of Mr. Roush's production budget, everything. And we had to scramble and steal and, you know, equipment from other places. Anyway, we'd get money to run on because we had no backing from Midland as far as research money. And but it just slowly developed, and finally we became probably the more dominant research group in the company in the 60s.
I have a note here. You did some early work on ethylene oxide polymerizations. Now I'm quoting, he learned the hard way. He had many unscheduled explosions before he learned how to remove the heat buildup.
Where'd you get this quote from?
That's from the Dow research history.
Oh, you mean reading the book?
Yes.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, you see, I was assigned right off of Earl to look into alkaline oxides, their polymerization, what we're going to do with them, whether we're going to make ethers, or we're going to make glycols, what we're going to do with these things. You know, they had certain uses to make plain ethylene antifreeze. That was what they were really for, antifreeze. Or sometimes the propylene was used for a defoaming agent, but that's all. The only person who knew anything about alkaline oxide was a guy named Staudinger over in Germany. Remember him? And I had read him, and he didn't have much to say, but he did know that alkali, like KOH or caustic and those kind of things, would polymerize. So I started doing this. My first experiments was in a big steam oven. That is big as that, only it's tall and about all the way to the floor, with big wooden doors with a big latch on it, and it was a steam oven. So I would take, when I was working first with ethylene oxide, I would take ethylene oxide, put it in those vials, and chill it down, and I'd put in caustic and KOH and things like that. And then I'd seal them up, wrap them up in cloth towel or something, and put them in those ovens, see if they would thicken. And well, they time go on, you know, I'd look in there and I'd shake them to see how thick they're getting. Yeah, pretty thick. So one day I went in there and I looked, I had about four or five of these big old tube, about that big, about that long, and I shake it, see how thick this getting, and I said, well, I'll just move them up. Each shelf was a little hotter because of the steam set up. I wrapped them back in their towel and put them up in another shelf and just shut the door, and it had taken about five steps and all those vials came apart. They blew up. Glass towels went through my legs and back. Didn't hurt me, but man, if I'd done, that had happened just a few seconds, it had been right in my face, you know. Well, I learned right a lot about oxides right quick, that you had to be careful with them and what would happen. And so I went through all this learning stage about how you got to polymerize those things as you feed them in. You just can't go load up a big vial or a kettle full of this stuff because you blow it up, you know. And I did a lot of work on trying to make the butyl ether of propylene glycol with BF3 on a continuous basis. This works very fast, but you never could get the all the fluorine out of the things, where it caused corrosion, you know. But that was my early stages, and then this was in just kind of the lab. Then I moved over to this kind of a pilot plant area. In fact, I moved into a big old warehouse. What's these name of these?
The Butler?
Butler buildings. Yeah, and didn't even have a dirt floor in them. Well, my first lab I set up over there was in the crapper. Absolutely. I put a lattice rack. There's a great big building, and it had two stalls at the end. Well, there's a building maybe just about the size of this room. Scrapper's down here, and I set me up a lattice rack over here. Couldn't stand that very long. Finally, I got me another lab and built it. Started doing all kind of things and trying to figure out what we were going to do with alkaline oxides. And we developed a series of ethylene glycols, polyethylene glycols, polyethylene propylene, you know, go up to a certain molecular weight. And what was always puzzling to me, particularly in ethylene oxide, you'd make an E600, that's ethylene oxide, 600 molecular weight. You get that by end groups. One time it'd be liquid, and next time it'd be solid. And I said, what in the world? Why would this be? You know, all this was in the beginning when nobody knew it. Well, it was molecular distribution, see, which you had no way of really measuring. But anyway, I couldn't figure this out the longest. How one time I'd make these things, and I thought the same way, exactly the same way, and one of them would be a solid, one of them would be a liquid. And I couldn't figure out. But some reason, somehow, something I did different, I'd change the distribution and get enough in there to make it solid.
How did you determine then that it was the distribution that was the cause of that?
Well, I think I started trying to skim out by temperature control the solids and measuring the molecular weights, and it was very crude, I know, but we were pretty sure that's what it was. We didn't have any real good method of doing it other than just some sort of a oddball scheme, that
were you doing this on a small scale or a pilot? Was this the pilot?
Well, it'd be in like 5-gallon kettles. I had several little 1-gallon, 5-gallon, 10-gallon, little autoclaves that I was doing this work in, where you'd feed the oxide in as fast as it polymerized to be sure you didn't blow up anything. Now, I come very close to blowing up something. See, we generally had for ethylene oxide, we had these... cylinders, about that tall, about that big around. They stand quite a bit of pressure, and they had soft plugs in case something happened. But I'd gotten one time that had some vinyl chloride in it. Well, I took it and steamed it and washed it and steamed it and washed it. I knew I had it clean. Then I put ethylene oxide in it. And filled it up with ethylene oxide, and then you use that to feed over into your kettle. Well, that had set there about a week. And somebody said, say, that cylinder out there, I was in my lab, is kind of jumping around. I dashed out there. Sure enough, that thing was just jumping all over the place. What it had done, it had blown its soft plug at the bottom. And it was just absolutely having a fit. But this is where I learned, one of the things I learned, see, there was enough zinc, see, those things are zinc lined. There was enough zinc chloride left. I'd steamed them. But there was enough zinc chloride in there to have started slowly but surely building temperature, pleo polymerization, to the point it got high enough that it set off a chain reaction. And it was right in that. And man alive, the top soft plug blew, but that thing, it enlarged 3 inches, but didn't blow up. Well, that's where I learned, ionic chlorides will polymerize the heck out of oxides, violently.
We'll come to that, but you did a lot of other work on ionic polymerization. Was that the first, your first
Well, that was just one learning lesson. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one learning lesson.
I also have a note here. I think it was at this time that you had the first air-conditioned building in the Texas Division.
Yeah, right. This is where we decided to build a laboratory out of rice brick. Somebody had come up with a new deal where they were taking rice hulls, mixing concrete, and making a brick that had good insulation qualities. And it was experimental, but I needed a laboratory. I decided we'd just build us a lab with no windows and put rice brick, and it'd be cool. It's hot down there, you know. And we went out and scrambled up an old heater. Normally you put steam through it, and you blow and heat things. Well, instead of putting steam through it, I ran pipes across the street to one of the chlorinated solvent plants and tapped off of their brine. They had to have brine to run a lot of their distillation, you know. And I didn't tell anybody. I just tapped off the line, plugged it into my blower. Man, I had the best air-conditioned lab in the whole. Everybody came in there. Man, it was nice. It was really nice. It was just perfect. And I could control that thing. And boy, everybody loved it. But finally, one time, the owner, old Tom Brown, traced that line on me. He gave me thunder. Then I had to start paying him for the use of the brine I was using. They put a meter on it.
How long did it take him to find
it? Oh, a long time. I think, I don't know, a year, 6 months.
Really?
Yeah. Before they ever detected. I don't know. They begin to suspect they're losing brine somewhere, and they couldn't figure out where. But we did this one night, you know, when nobody was around. Oh, we did all kind of things to keep in existence at night. We made midnight requisitions everywhere on the production people, you know, and from each other, you know.
In 1946, you became project leader. That may already be the time that you're talking about, but I wanted to ask you about that. There was a series of positions, and I'm not sure what it was entailed with your responsibilities as project leader.
Well,
you're still within the organic.
Yeah. A project leader really just the next step up where you are responsible for more than just your projects, and you've got, say, two or three, four, maybe, guys working for you. That way, you then can take on most of the projects or ones you want done, but you've got somebody else doing them for you or helping you. So I would have, as a project leader, probably four people helping me.
And it was at that time you also went to Brooklyn Poly.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Now,
but in the interim, you see, I don't know how these questions come, but we set out to make a series of polyglycols. You know, good, solid, water white polyglycol for antifreeze, for other uses that would be stable, you know, stable, and they wouldn't have a bitter taste. Boy, taste is one of the important things in polyglycols, and for that matter, in antifreeze, are particularly the ones that goes into extracts and tobacco and stuff, you know. You got that aftertaste is just absolutely better beyond. Well, this is genotropine, but it can be aftertaste. But so we worked on all that to refine the quality of the glycols. Then we started making the glycol derivatives, particularly for our surfactants and detergents. That was our goal, to make good surfactants and detergents for de-emulsifiers, for the oil industry, detergents, even maybe for washing powders, but mainly for industrial detergents, what we were really aiming at. Then we got involved, I'm not sure just the sequence of these, in synthetic lubricants.
Okay.
And we got hooked up with Standard Oil of California. See, at that time, boy, you take up, well, like today or particularly up in Alaska and Canada, you couldn't hardly run your car in the wintertime. Absolutely couldn't run it. Most people ran them on kerosene, you know, and that's very poor lubricating oil, you know. Or they take kerosene, put a little oil in it, you know. A terrible situation, most. And so Standard Oil had a lot of business in Alaska and Canada, or high north, Montana. So they wanted a synthetic lubricant. So we started making, looking into this. And we could make very, very good lubricants with high viscosity index. But they weren't stable enough. You'd run them a while and they'd get acid, you know. So we had to go to working on how to build these things and make them stable, and we did. We got some very good-looking synthetic lubricants. And we got to the point, see, I've made many a trip out to Standard Oil there in Oakland. Anyway, this fellow Hughes, you may know this name, from Ohio, came in and gave this big presentation on VI improvers. And I remember this conference well, where everybody thought, well, this is just false rethinking, there's nothing to this. Others, yeah, it is. Hughes was very defensive of it. And, of course, I just sat mainly and listened, but all the experts on the oil business, there was a big divided camp of where this meant anything or not, but it meant a heck of a lot because it was real. You know, we've used them slowly but ever since. Well, that put us out of the synthetic lubricant business. Now you can take a regular oil, thin oil, thin enough that you can run it, but you can thicken it to where it'll run with high heat. And that just eliminated us as a VI, as a synthetic lubricant business. If that hadn't come along, we'd have been big in that thing. Man, we had a good deal. But they didn't need it, too costly. And this was so much cheaper. And it turned out it was real, and it just went on and was a good deal. But in this period, Joe Bagg and I kept fiddling with, I just knew that somehow ionic compounds and salts and things, you know, we used BF3 and we'd used zinc chloride and we started trying to figure out, well, zinc chloride is very volatile. Man, it is potent stuff, you know, almost everything. And then we tried, well, maybe ferric chloride. But even ferric chloride, raw ferric dropped in PO is violent, you know. So we started getting acetone solution, cooling it down to acetone, about a minus 20 or something, you know, and slowly dropping acetone in there and getting polymer. Well, that's still not very good, but what we found out was that, okay, we make this polymer, and we pull this, it makes a kind of a brown stuff. If we take this out and extract it and dry it, then we've got a catalyst that's much more controllable. And so we slowly came up with this complex that a lot of other people would have come up with, you know. by just kind of serendipity, you know.
I think you have a patent on that, as
yeah.
I recall.
Yeah, we have a patent on this catalyst. And we'd make this, and the way we'd make the polymer most of the time would be to take a rotating autoclave, 5-10 gallons, and cool it down with acetone solution or some other cooling just through a pipe. And we would put the required amount of ferric chloride complex in there and seal it off right quick. Then it would go through an exerm. A lot of people thought, boy, you're going to blow one of these up sometime. But it'd go through an exerm. Boy, and then just quit. And then it'd polymerize. But this exerm never blew up anything. It just went so far, and that was it. And we had it under good control. You know, we got to where we knew exactly what this was going to be. So we could run pretty sizable hunks of stuff because it always come out the same. And we would it make both isotactic or what we call crystalline and amorphous polymer, and they would separate it by acetone solution into the high molecular weight and the more amorphous. And this, I was really going all out to figure out how in the world I was going. The melting point was only about 70 to 80 degrees. And how in the world do you get this? Well, maybe way in the early stages, I'm trying to measure the thing here. As I got to fooling around with polymers, I didn't know a thing about polymers. I was working strictly on observation. Didn't know a thing about polymerization, didn't know anything. So I went, this is where I went to Brooklyn Polytech for 6 weeks, or 3 weeks, I guess it is. I don't remember if it's three or six. I think it's three. Course at Brooklyn Polytech, because I felt that was the best place, well, it was by far then, the best place to go. And Turner Alfrey was the director of the school that year. And Mark was there, and Overberger was there, and what this guy, Moravia?
Morowitz?
Huh?
Morowitz?
The guy that went to, yeah, Marvitz was there, but it seemed like there's another Moravian there. It was all, they were all good guys. And I learned, man, I did learn a lot. I'll tell you, I learned what polymerization was all about, you know. And it's been the basis then for me to think on ever since. And they taught us a lot in that period of time. Taught us an awful lot.
Did anyone else from Dow go at the same time, or were you the
I don't
only
believe.
One?
I believe I was the only one from Dow. I believe I was the only one.
Were there other industrial people?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't really recall, there's a girl there who was very good in math. I don't recall and now any of the other people who were there. Really. I remember the professors well. I remember that old Turner Alfrey, we had our, when we finished the day we finished, we had a big beer bust right there in the lake. And he had a card tied up for, see who could kick that card as we kept raising it. You know, we had a big time. I enjoyed that. Learned a lot. Really did. Really did. They were good at it, and so I met Mark, and I met Turner, and I met Overberger, and I met. I'm going to say Messeravian. Is that name right?
I'm not sure. We can check that. I'm not
Messeravian. He went with some. I won't say tin company. But anyway, there's about four of them there. Yeah. I came back, and that helped me immensely as far as understanding what was going on, you know. Well, then we kept going with this polymer thing. And then right after that, not long, I don't know, maybe a year or so after that, Turner came to Dow. and became, you know, a very important power man up here with Ray Bowyer and others. And I was still trying to figure out how to get the molecular weight up, make this in. See, I was trying to make it into a plastic, which it's really not suited as a. I don't know. You just can't get that molecular weight up. I don't care what you do. I mean, the melting point. You can just keep carrying the molecular weight out, and it don't go up. It just don't go up. But anyway, I invited Turner Alfred to come down Texas one time. I says, come down here and show me and tell me what I got to do. Well, I was real disappointed in Turner. He came down and looked around and went home and offered not one suggestion. Well, what it turned out was this was a completely, see, I was in a whole new field that nobody knew anything about. Nobody. I didn't realize that. And he's a vinyl polymerization man. And this was ionic polymerization in glycols, which he had no experience. And he couldn't offer any better suggestion than I had because he didn't know. He didn't have any experience. But I kind of got disillusioned with the experts because I figured they ought to come down and give me the answer. But I could see over the years why that was true. And we were plowing completely new ground. And then Charlie, your man up there, Charlie
Price.
Charlie Price started picking up doing this same kind of work. He had been playing around with KOH and propylene oxide, making mostly liquids. And man, he was really intrigued with this idea you could make solids. So he did a lot of work himself on this following, and we had a lot of correspondence. I'd never met Charlie Price, but we had a lot of conversation on the phone and letters. And he had a lot of good thoughts, and we worked together a good bit. Then a fellow named Furukawa over at Kyoto University picked up on this. Became a very good friend of mine. Came to the U.S. and I went over to see him a time or two. And he worked in this field awful lot. Now, the thing was, if Dow had been a rubber company, see, it turns out it's a rubber done right. If we had been a rubber company, we understood rubber. I'm not so sure that PO polymers wouldn't be a good rubber today before all these others caught on. You ever get established, you know, you're in pretty good shape. Because with the proper work, which has never really been done on PO, because it turns out now it's too high, compared to some of the others, but it made a very stable rubber and a very high-low temperature rubber, so forth. But never, just couldn't make a plastic. I was trying to make a plastic out of it. But anyway, I did a lot of that work on the ionic polymerization. In 1965, just to follow up on this, the Japanese had a big EPAC meeting on ionic polymerization in Kyoto University. Furukawa, those people were handling it, I guess. And I was invited. Only three industrial people were invited. Me, what's the guy from DuPont, and then he went to Massachusetts, starts with V, Volker?
Yes.
Volker. Volker at that time was with DuPont. Volker was invited, and the guy from Hercules that did the epi work for them, I can't think of that name. You don't know that name?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
We were the three people invited, only three industrial people in the world. And they, at that meeting, they had all these fancy names I'd been reading in reports and articles around the world from Russia, England, and Canada, and Japan, and everywhere else. Man, they had a room full of these people. And they went on for 2 days, and I sat there quietly and listened. And I got a little disillusioned. They'd bring up problems, and I said to myself,
If that's a problem, they could solve that in 15 minutes if they just go do the right experience. It looks like all they want to do is just talk about it. And I think that. Anyway. So at the end, Charlie Price got up to summarize the conference. Charlie Price. And I was sitting back there with a little Roker. And he says, you know, we've been going on 2 days now, and the father of ionic polymerization is here with us, but we haven't heard from him. And I said to myself, I wonder who that is. And he said, it's Mac Pruitt, the alchemical company. Boy, I never dreamed, you know. But they were giving me credit for having done the first ionic polymerization through this work, which by patent and everything, I guess that's right. But I never dreamed about it anyway. He was very complimentary, and I thought, well, gee, McCook's no wonder I'm invited, you know? Because I kind of wondered why I was invited with all this room full of all these expert academic guys, you know? So, let's see now. Okay.
Would you say that's the difference between an industrial chemist and an academic person? The academics seemed to talk about it while you just went ahead and did the experiment.
Yeah. Well, a little bit. Now, not everybody, but I think they are. A lot of academic people, if they solve the problem, wouldn't have anything to talk about. I was serious. They get up, and I knew a lot about some of the things they were talking about. I knew. See, I had also resolved earlier in my career that my goal in life, this was before Dow started pushing me every direction, that I was going to become. And I did this because another thing I had done about the second year I was in research there, I decided to go down to the University of Houston and get my master's degree. And I talked to Earl about it, you know, the director, and he thought it okay. So 3 of us guys drove to Houston twice a week to start taking a master's in chemistry. Well, they were just setting up their masters. They just started, and they just had one woman, a lady, who was kind of running the organic part, and she was teaching these courses at night, and just 3 and her. They set them up specially for us. We were kind of breaking in their masters, you know. And this lady, who was, by the way, I thought an excellent teacher and a very good chemist, she was absolutely scared to death of us. That we, here in 3 big industrial chemists, and we probably knew twice as much as she did, which wasn't true, but all she would do is sign, read chapters so-and-so, and she wouldn't hardly, well, sometimes she wouldn't even come, she'd just miss. And I think she got to the point where she'd absolutely scared to death to come meet with us, afraid we was going to embarrass her, you know.
And do you remember her name?
No, I don't. I can see her face.
What about the text you were reading from?
Well, I think the text we were using was Gilmer. I think it was the text we're studying from. You know Gilmer?
Gilmer or Gilman?
Gilman. Yeah, okay, Gilman. Okay. And anyway, I finally decided, I went back there and told him, I said, I think I can learn more by just concentrating on my job and studying on my own when I need to know something rather than going doing that till they get themselves set up in a more, you know, so I never did go back.
Did the others continue or did they?
No, they quit too. They quit too. But I think now they've got a nice program, but, you know, in the early stages, it just wasn't enough there to do much with. Now, I did take physical chemistry down there under Dr. Drake. Remember him? He's a crippled fellow. Man, he was good. I retook the physical chemistry or a little, I don't know whether it was advanced course or, but that helped me because I was working so much in ACU or North Texas, I didn't get a very good course in physical chemistry. And I was working so much with gases and all these conditions, you know, that physical chemistry was very essential. So I took a course in that from Drake. who had been there for years and teaching this, and man, he was really good. And that really helped me. But we didn't learn hardly anything out of this organic course except what we just read for ourselves, you know.
I have some other notes here, things that happened at around this time, in looking through your patents. I was struck by the fact that you have two patents on plant growth medium. How did that...
Yeah, well, okay. Now, see, when I was over at Plant A, in the semi-plant setting, most of my work was in alkaline oxides of some sort, most of it. You know, either the polymerization of, or the derivatives of, or lubricants of, and so forth. And we had come up, we had one patent, you see, in there, where we made the triols of glycerin, which is a very vital product. It is the guts of the urethane business today. And, of course, at that time, we didn't know anything about urethanes. We were trying to make it into a good detergent or surfactant. And then we moved over to Plant A into the new research center, and I had a new building and a new lab and became director of research of organic product development lab. And I began to take on quite a few things. And one of the things was, some of our people out in the field, our salespeople, had spotted the idea, say, urethane is taking off in Europe, and they're showing their head just a little in this country, people looking at them. But wasn't anything going on. And I said, well, I looked into that. I said, okay, if nobody else in Dow, I'm going to become the urethane man in Dow. And I'm going to work that technology up. So I went to work real hard with my people, setting up one group on the polyol side and one group on the urethane side, developing the urethane. So we came up with all kind of urethanes, catalysts, and the polyols, and all the technologies therewith. And, of course, the first thing we shot after was flexible foam, you know, making polyols to make flexible foam for furniture and so forth, bedding. And we came up, carbide was coming up right with us, and maybe one or two others, all competing, but we was right there from the first, maybe the first, you know. And we had a good products, good system, and we've been big in this, you know, a long time. So I put Dow into the urethane business. And time went on. This Joe Baggett, who worked kind of, he was a kind of a loner, he was a kind of a sloppy, he didn't hardly know one molecule from another, but I used him all the time to work with me to do things that I wanted carried out, and he had a lot of serendipity to observe things and then come back and tell me about them, a lot of other people wouldn't. And so as we began to make these flexible foams, we began to, I don't know, I can't tell you for exactly what got me onto this, but see, I got this patent all alone. Then I signed Joe to spend more time, and then the guy named Mel Hanley. But we found out that we could put nutrients and foam them in place in this foam, and they would be ideal growing media. And it's a heck of a good idea, except you're trying to replace dirt. That's pretty hard to do. But we began to experiment. What we wanted is permanency, where that nutrient would stay there. See, if you just put a soluble salt, well, in no time it's gone. We started putting salt that would stay in there and leach out slowly and would last for years. And you know these slow-growing houseplants, we could put them in there and it'd stay 3 or 4 years. All you had to do is just put a little water on them. That's all. You know? And grow fine. Great. If you knew how to do it and And in fact, I've got a Christmas cactus in my house today that stayed in one of those forms 40 years without anything except water. And then it began to play out, and I had to put dirt around it and, you know, and start doing different, but 14 years. And especially were they good for orchids. You know, they like a kind of a funny... And we actually got a guy up in East Texas there to actually set up a big greenhouse, and he just grew orchids like mad in these things. And then a company in Houston actually went in the bin and set up a production line to make these Nutrifoam pots. But just couldn't make enough money out of them, you know. People really like to play in dirt. And they just, so we decided, yeah, there's just not enough there. This company went at this a good while, but they finally pulled away, I think. But that's, we call it Nutrifoam. It's a great idea. We had a greenhouse out there just full of everything under the sun growing in this. It's just beautiful. Just beautiful. You know? But not really a good commercial deal. But I tried, you know, in my career through there in Texas, I was trying all kind of oddball things like that, you know, because it's interesting, and you never know when one of them might click, but if it shows you where there's a reason why it's just not going to be commercially, you just can't continue to spend money on it.
You're working ionic polymerization then. Is that one of the reasons you moved away from that? Because you did some of the early work, but it was never, you never really published it that much or pursued it within the company. Is that true?
Oh, we never published anything outside the company. I never wrote, I don't think I ever wrote a paper outside the company. That last thing I wanted to do, tell somebody else what was.
No, I understand, but... I guess what I'm after is the fact that the ionic polymerization work did not continue that. You moved on to other areas then.
Oh yeah, I had to. You see, they were demanding that I do other things, and yeah, I began to broaden out into all kind of areas. The PO polymer, I just couldn't get it up to be a plastic. We had nobody in Dow who could look at it as a elastomer. And I wasn't very experienced in elastomers, so we just didn't. Now, one other development out of this over the period, we continued on this off and on quite a bit, and we got with Goodyear one time, had a joint venture kind of in research, where they would try to put it into a rubber, especially rubber. but that time, they had already developed these ethylene, propylene, tri rubbers and a lot of other rubbers, isoprenes and stuff that they'd put so much money into them that, you know, just no way for this order to get there. But I thought for a while Goodyear, but they finally decided, well, we just can't afford that many different rubbers. I thought they was going to really put it over because they had a pilot plant, Goodyear, working with us very closely on making PO rubber for specialties. But, you know, you can just spend so much money on so many projects, and the others were so far along, and I don't know, probably cheaper now, because PO oxide, and those are pretty high now, so I don't know. But in the end of the PO polymer, where I was trying to figure out how to get that molecular weight up, change the molecular weight, raise the melting point, the big problem was molecular weight. How in the world do you measure molecular weight, and particularly molecular distribution? So with a fellow named John Moore, you've heard, I'm sure, was there and working in the basic research, and I got Earl to let him sign him to me, and his job was to figure out, you see, up in Midland, up here, you know, people like Lu Hotung, and you know Lu Hotung? He's one of Dow's kind of basic characterizing polymer men. And all the people, you know, Ray and Turner and all those people, all they had was sand filters and centrifuges, and, you know, and all that's a mess. Ain't worth a dime, as far as I'm concerned. And so I signed Johnny Moore. You figure out a way to determine the molecular weight of polymers and the molecular distribution. So he went to work on this, and he got a pretty devious mind. And we started out first trying to see if we could do it by end groups. But, you know, it got so, we're getting up to 100, 100, 200, 300 molecular weight. And there's no way you could get the distribution anyway. Well, it looked pretty discouraging, but somehow or another, he stumbled on the idea of beads would separate polymer size. I know, I guess you know what I'm leading to, if you're a polymer man at all. And that began to look better and better and better. But you could take a, you know, very dilute solution of polymer, put it through a bead column, and you can come out with the molecular weight and the molecular distribution. And we invented gel permeation chromatography. Probably the best tool polymer has ever and ever will have. Are you familiar with GPB much?
To a certain extent.
Well, boy, if you're not, you ought to get more acquainted with it. That is absolutely unbelievable. Well, even with that, we still couldn't figure out any way to get the melting point up. But about that time, see, we had gotten in the, and I was right in the middle of this, we'd got involved in polyethylene. We'd bought the ICI process. We'd built a plant. And I wasn't backing up the existing product line. That was done by the manufacturing groups. But I was involved in trying to find new copolymers of polyethylene or new things like, for instance, the ethylene acrylic acid copolymers, which is now just now beginning to be big business, and all kind of things. Then we got in such trouble with our polymer line, because this is where I was just telling the new research director yesterday, don't ever let sales business people and the manufacturing people get involved in backing up your products alone without research, because you'll go to pot every time. And we got in such trouble with our products, we were losing $2 million a month on polyethylene. This is way back then. And so they were going to just flush it out. Well, a guy named Brooke down in Texas and myself decided, hey, give us a shot. We'll take the research. I'll take the research. Brooke took the manufacturing. We started trimming the product lines out, and if I hadn't had GPC, I'd have never made it. But I'm telling you, you put a polymer in that GPC machine, and it, in 2 hours, or hour, it'll plot out the molecular weight and distribution. And if you get the same molecular distribution curve, you've got exactly the same polymer every time. Every time. So we could take a carbide product or anybody else and get the molecular distribution. Here, they had a good product eating us up with it. And then we could slowly, right quickly, we could duplicate that and find out how to make a product similar to that or one even better in no time with this instrument. So, boy, we improved that product line overnight. You know, they thought we'd perform miracles, which we had. And we got the polyethylene line back on track and made a fortune out of it for years, you know. But that was due to GPC. GPC is unbelievable, too, and I think everybody in the polymer business knows it. Well, now, I don't know whether this ought to be on record or not, but we could get no attention to this instrument in Midland. None. Absolutely none. I come up and pled with them, because we were already doing great things in polyethylene. And this includes Ray Bandy, Ray Bollier, Turner Alfred, Lou Houghton, all of them. Well, I think it's this idea, you know, where these little young upstarts down there don't know what they're doing. They couldn't have anything, I guess. I don't know. I tried to hit the sales department to use it in their advertising, show how good we were in polymer. So one day I told Ray Bollier and Ray Bandy, well, if you don't think this thing's very important, I'm going to go sell it, because there are people going to be on their back and going to invent this, and guys going to lose out. They said, well, fine. I didn't look back. I went home, got our local lawyer down there in Dow, and I sold this to Waters Associates.
Hmm.
Are you familiar with Waters?
Yes. Yes.
Little upstart company. This guy Waters, he didn't hardly have anything, but it's the best thing we ever did, because he was willing to put a lot of development time and money into it. Whereas somebody like Foxborough or somebody would probably just done another product, you know, and it might have fallen. Anyway, we went to work for that company and started developing GPC, and man, for no time, we had this all over the industry. And John Moore, who was the inventor, he developed this thing, a guy named John Moore, was in demand to make talks all over the world. Now, mainly to the analytical type folks.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he did a lot of it to help Waters promote the product. Everybody down there didn't get that much credit, because we let Waters take the front. And today, well, ever since then, every time I go out somewhere and we talk about polymers, I say, well, you know about GPC? Oh, yeah. I said, do you know who invented it? Well, no. So we have got not proper credit, nor did John Moore get proper credit for inventing it, probably. Wasn't long ago, a couple of guys from Bell Labs called Ray Bollier, here just like a month ago, saying, where is John Moore? We don't think he got enough credit, he got any awards at all or anything for inventing this. And they'd been looking in the chromatography award and seeing any news, and here got this and that. So Ray called me and got me in contact with him, and I said, absolutely, I think he never got credit, nor did Dow get credit for this. And John Moore now is retired and living in Florida, still alive. Anyway, I think that's probably the greatest invention we ever came up with, the GPC. And the reason it came is because if you want to invent something, John, is to have a real need and demand that it be filled. Boy, I've got more inventions, particularly in instruments, because there's a real need, and you tell your people you got to have an answer. And they know exactly what they're shooting for. And somewhere, you got a bunch of smart people, you'll get the answer. For instance, urethanes, we were doing a lot of work in foam, rigid foam for insulation, you know, like polystyrene. All this is urethanes. And all the work on this had been done in Midland on polystyrene. Well, I got to working on it in Texas on polyurethane. And the big thing is to measure the K factor, you know, the insulation quality. And you know, the instrument we had been developed, I guess, in Midland or somewhere, took 24 hours to get a K factor on a piece of foam. And when I ran into that, I said, that's absolutely asinine. We got to beat that. I told my guys, I want a machine that I can take a piece of foam and I stick it in a slot and it'll read off what the K factor is, just like that. I want that kind of machine now. So they went to work and they almost invented it. They came up with a machine that'll read it off in 10 minutes. And that assumed it's still the standard today. But we invent more instruments in Dow because of need and know what
have to have. A guy who's trying to invent an estimate, sitting out here, an estimate company in a, you know, just an open room, he's got a problem. But where you've got a need, boy, I tell you, it really comes.
You also did some work on rocket propellants.
Yeah, we. The reason we did that, we got in a few government contracts, but we had a fella, a guy who worked for me kind of directly, named Wallace McMichaels, who came from the government. Well, see, now he worked for who did he work for? What company? Not Thiokol. Oh, can't tell you. That come. He worked for, I want to say Phillips, but. And he was in this arsenal up at McGregor, Texas, working on propellants for this company. Very interested in. He came to work for Dow, and so he kind of plugged in the idea of some of the using, well, you know, like PO polymer, it's got a lot of oxygen in it, it burns easy, and it make an excellent binder for a rocket. So we did a lot of work on that. We never did, we just didn't know enough about it, or frankly, the company didn't show any interest. You know, we developed things, and we have no way of, if you don't have a way of moving on a project, sometimes they just die. I'm not so sure we couldn't have done a lot more good, but we, there's just a lot of other things with higher priority in the company than this. But we did do quite a bit, mainly through the interest of him and his knowledge that we did this at all. And we never did get too far with it. I kind of regret that sometimes. A lot of things we could have led up on and done better, but gee, you know, there's just so many things coming at you. And like they throw the whole polyethylene research on you, you've got to deliver, you know, and a lot of other stuff matter. And so some of these newer things sometimes kind of get put by the wayside. But I'm sure if somebody took out to find real good uses for polypropylene oxide, they'd find them. But we just didn't have a way of getting to that, seemed like.
I want to come back to that point. I have something I wanted to ask you about a little later. But at this point, I have some names of people you were associated with in Texas, and you've already discussed a few of them, but let me mention them and see if you have any other comments you wanted to make. Earl Barnes especially, because you worked closely with him for a long period of time.
Earl Barnes, see, I transferred, you know, Dr. Wright to his group, and I have essentially worked with Earl the rest of my career. I've worked with other temporary other report to other people, but Earl and I have been side by side for ever since. And we're two of the best friends there are and trust each other implicitly. Earl Barnes probably, in my opinion, the best executive director Dow ever had, ever will have. He's unbelievable. He's truly interested in technology. Very creative. People's skills are unbelievable. Motivating power to get people to do things new. Well, I guess the most fortunate thing ever happened to me in Dow is the fact that I worked with Earl Barnes. Because he trusted me. He believed in what anything I wanted to do. He was behind me. That's the reason I went off and did a lot of screwy thing. Some of them worked, some of them didn't, because so many other bosses would have said, cut out that nonsense and get on with the everyday life, you know. And Earl and I talk even now. In fact, I was talking to him yesterday. He called me from Wyoming.
Yeah, unbelievable. Excellent scientist and excellent manager of people.
What about Walter Rausch?
Walt Rausch was the major manager of manufacturing in Texas, in which Earl, for the longest, worked. His research group worked under. We were the organic section of the Texas division. Fine man, hard boy. He wanted you to do right, and he expected you to do right. But first top notch guy, like him. He eventually became the technology center for all manufacturing for Dow, and been retired a good bit. But he held a good, hard, steady line. Everybody called him Papa Rausch.
Yes. Is it Butel?
A.P. Bartle?
Boydell.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, A.P. Bartle. Well, they just get more. A.P. Bartle, you know, went down and ran the Texas division. An unbelievable man. You know, probably hadn't been for Dr. Bartle. He put, of course, the first plant down there with him because that was a place to put magnesium production. But then he went into the petrochemical business down there. That was the place to do it in the South. Hadn't been for his ability to fight and get his way with the board, they'd have put a lot of that stuff up here. If they had, they'd never been the Dow Chemical Company. They probably went under. But he put all that stuff in Texas. And he set the tone for the Texas division people, you know, their aggressiveness, their risk-taking, their ability to fight, do everything you're big enough to do. Did that all his life. Even when he became in his middle 70s, still working, our director of search of Texas Division, he never failed. He lived up here running their government affairs then. Come into Texas, he never failed to give me a call. Come over and tell me what's new. He's always thinking about the future. See, that's what I call in Dow or in the chemical industry, really, the end of the age of the patriarchs. You see, we had people, very creative people like Herbert Dow, start these companies, a lot of them around. The Fords and the Willard Dow. I'm not Willard, Herbert Dow, and so forth. Then as he faded out, he developed a bunch of strong men under him. Guys like Strohsacker here in Dow, Boydell, a whole bunch of people who ran the company. They ran their section of the company like a king, you know, more or less. And they were risk takers, they were pioneers, they were tough. And a bunch of the business people didn't dominate them. They did what they told them to do. The business people wasn't running the company. They were running the company. And, of course, these patriarchs have all died out now. And now we swung around to the normal where the young 90-day wonder business people, I don't mean that derogatory, I mean it, have taken over. And they're running the companies. Now, Dow has held out longer on this than most companies. Now, they're being swung that way pretty strong now. Most other companies have gone that way, Carbide and Dow, DuPont. But anyway, there's, you know, there's phases that things seem to go through. And Dow has been very fortunate. See, we've been dominated because of that background. Dow Chemical has been dominated primarily by research and production. They hold the power, have had in the company. And that means we've had strong manufacturing and strong research and strong new development of products. when you swing around the other way, that slowly, it's like carbide. Carbide is gone from one of the toughest research competitors we ever had in the 50s and 60s to almost a has-been. Because they decimated the R&D and their manufacturing technology. That's the reason they're in all this trouble they're in. And I hope Dow don't go that away. And that's the reason I was talking to this new director yesterday, which he says he's not going to let it happen. Which I think maybe he might just can do it. Anyway, that's...
Did you know E.C. Britton?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Knew him well.
Did he come down to Texas?
Oh, yeah. In fact, he's my best, one of my best buddies. I worked very closely at his laboratory. I knew him well. And when they were building a new research center over in Freeport, you know, we had this old group of buildings and stuff over in Plant A, but we're going to build this new research center now over in Plant B, away from the plant a little bit, the Gulf a little bit. But they weren't, because of, I don't remember all the factors now, they were just going to put part of us over there. And I didn't have a laboratory over there. Doc Benton came down one day visiting, looking around and looking at the plans for the new research. He says, "Where's Mac Pruitt's laboratory? He's not over here." Next day, I was called up, "Get in here and plan your laboratory." So he's my buddy. I got me a brand new laboratory out of it. Doc was quite a guy. Quite a guy, storyteller, inventive, had a million ideas. Don't have them. We don't have them like that anymore.
The last name I have here is Shigley.
Yeah, Shigley. Shigley was over in the inorganic side of the Texas Division. His whole group was called Inorganic Group, which backed up the, you know, the magnesium and all everything we had in the way of inorganics. And he ran the that for years. Actually, he was one time the manager of Dow Magnesium Corporation. He was the plant manager for a while there. Then he moved back over to the research. And then he moved back up here and became involved in when Dr. Bartle moved. He was a good friend of Dr. Bartle's. And when he moved up here, he became involved in government affairs. Very nice gentleman, quite talented. But he and Earl were kind of in competition with each other for Dr. Bartle, because Earl ran all the organic and Shigley ran the inorganic. See, Earl never became full director of research, and then when Earl became general manager of the Texas Division and then moved to Midland, Shigley moved. Well, then Levi became the director of search. First time we ever had a director of search of all the research in Texas. And then I followed Leathers and was director of search of all the research.
That was in 65, I believe.
67.
67.
Became director of research at Texas Division.
What was the relationship at that time between Dow Texas and Midland? Is that the time you, that period, 65 to 71, before you moved to Midland?
That's good. In the, where the Texas Division did the best research, probably, well, I won't say that completely. We did a lot of good research in the 60s, particularly in new products, urethanes, epoxies, derricane, all kinds of copolymers of ethylene. You can just name them. I can just name them dozens of them. The Michigan Division had kind of gotten, they had had this central research go off, and they become kind of high-toned. You remember the time when the research all of a sudden in the industry felt like they was kind of academic and they're getting high-toned? And they felt like they were a little too good to work with the business TSD groups. They was going to go off and do their thing. And the Michigan Division research had been clobbered to where they were in. So this area was pretty bleak in results in the 60s. Texas was at its peak. And I was a new product man. Levi and McClure were the more processed people. I worked very closely. In fact, I was on the two first business. We started the business team concept. I was on the two first business teams they had up here. We worked very closely with the business people in the tech service. And that's the reason we were able to develop so well, because we were just hand in glove, and there wasn't anybody in up top management bothering either of us. We just did our things. We did something we got onto something wasn't any good, we just buried it and didn't tell anybody. And that's the ideal way to do products. If you carry, and this is what I'm afraid now, if you carry all the decisions about new products too high in the company, you've got troubles, because they can't afford to fail, the top management. Mm-hmm. Guys like me down in the trenches down there in the labs, we could fail all day long and go as long as we could bear them, and nobody knew how to get in there and figure out what we were doing. As long as we were successful enough on most of the things, and that's, we worked hand in glove with the product department. We didn't blame anybody. We protected each other. And man, we developed the products. And we had people like old John Donalds and that kind of folks helping us, you know. So we came up with all kind of things in the 60s. So the relationship between Texas and the business and the TS&D was excellent. I would say the relationship between the central research and Texas was good, but not, still a little jealousy, you know, between the two groups. This is one reason why I couldn't get GPC accepted. Some of that. It wasn't bad at all. It was good.
Is this when you started the work in the polycarbonate resins?
I started work on polycarbonates. See, we had gotten bisphenol A, see, and all the raw materials for polycarbonates. In about 65, I decided, well, now Dow ought to be in the polycarbonates now, somewhere, somehow. And it was tough because Bayer had all the patents and GE was there, both good. So I went to work trying to buy the technology from Bayer. I made a trip to Germany, went to their plastics people. They said, you're crazy, the market's not going to grow and you don't need to be in there, we're not going to sell you anything. Okay. Came home, and one time the president of Bayer was in Freeport visiting Dr. Bartle. So I got Earl. I said, Earl, here's the time. Let's sell this guy on licensing us the technology. But we talked to him, and he said, fine, sounds like a good deal to me. Boy, I said, gee, we got it made. But, boy, when we went home, we went back to the same people I'd went to, no soap. So if we're going to get into polycarbonate business, we'd have to develop our own technology and get around all the patents. So we slowly went to work in the lab, just one or two people playing around, finding out, doing this, doing that. No backing from anybody. We didn't want any backing. And we began to learn things and do things and find out things. And slowly, slowly, yeah. It's just one of those, we've developed our all technology 100% within Dow.
It was in 71 that you then moved on to Midland.
Yeah.
How did that move come about?
Okay. Julius Johnson was director of research. He had taken Ray Boundy's place. But they wanted Julius to move out of that job and take over the worldwide pharmaceutical business. And by that time, Earl Barnes was director, was president of the Dow USA. You know, we got Dow USA, Dow Europe and areas. So Earl wanted me to come take Julius's place. I'm not so sure that some of the board members, they probably wanted somebody up here, I'm sure. I don't know all the conversation, but Earl had really the choice because he was president. So he called me and said, I'd like for you to come up here. Well, one thing I'd said, I'll never move to Midland, Michigan. That's the last place I'll go. But I'd been coming up here twice a month for years to all these business teams. You know, and that's a burden. You know what, traveling. You've just been through it. Traveling up here is worse than living here, frankly. But anyway, I didn't like the idea of leaving my home. But Earl said, well, how about coming up? We're not sure what we want to do. How about coming up temporarily for about 6 months? Well, I couldn't say no to that, but I knew what he was doing to me. So he said, I'll rent your house, furnish it, place for you to live and everything in that 6 month period. So I move up here in this thing they've got fixed up for me. I moved up here in June, I believe, like May or June. But I knew I was hooked when I moved, but at least you rationalize, well, maybe I'll get to go back. But frankly, I began to like it immediately. I tell you, the challenge of the job and everything and what was going on, and I knew that if I didn't take it, somebody else would, and they might not do as good as I thought I could do. So September, of course, became permanent and took the job. But anyway, Earl snuck up on me, got me up here. But see, I was 57 then, when I moved up here. And that's another thing I thought about. You know, why would they want to fix it? Today they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't think about that.
Really?
No. But I think it's wise to take people who've been there. I knew this company like a book. And probably knew research about as good or better than anybody in the company. Earl knew that. But today, they'd go pick up somebody who didn't know nothing about. You know, the theory today is, a good man can do anything anywhere you put him, and the younger the better. And this is good and bad. But if a guy hadn't earned his spurs, it demoralizes a lot of people. And you don't want to make too many moves where you put people who haven't earned their spurs. Well, I'd earned mine. I'd been there a long time, done a lot of good, done a lot of products, been involved everything up here for years, business people and all. So I wasn't any stranger hardly to anybody.
Recently, Recently, I came across the following, which I thought I'd ask your opinion about. I think it might have been in Business Week. And I'm quoting here, at Dow, the new emphasis on commercial development looks very different from its old approach to new products. In the past, researchers would have done most of the early commercial development themselves, isolated from the realities of the marketplace. They would then have to twist the arms of Dow's different divisions to adopt the project and pay for further development. In other words, they were creating something new and then looking for a place for it. Now Dow pushes researchers to modify existing products to supply whatever the customer wants. In other words, listening to the marketplace and then going back to R&D.
Is this a recent quote?
Yes, I have it here somewhere.
Well, I don't really... In Business Week? Or CD News?
Chemical Business.
Who's speaking? Alan Brown. Well, what you're saying there is, if I read it, heard it right, is kind of contradictory. I was going to say, yeah, it's right and wrong, but you see, a lot of people, it depends on who you talk to in Dow, what answer you get about anything. And I think, frankly, Dow has done an excellent job of developing new technology. It's been from the inside, like they say, most of the time. And to me, that's a way to stay solid and sound. If you start, and this is what Dow will start doing right now, if you start acquisition, when business and financial people get control of a company, they don't know very much about technology. They want to make their mark. How do they make it? Financially. So they start making it by acquisition. Second, the businessman is not willing to take a risk. He wants a brand new product, bad. But he's not willing to take one that's going to take him 5 years to get it. He wants it to sell 10 million pounds tomorrow. That's, I mean, just natural. So what do? They go acquisition. Sometimes you can do okay with acquisition. Most of the time you lose your shirt. Carbide lost their shirt. They went acquisition. They went, started their research and went acquisition. Most companies lose out by going acquisition rather than staying with their own technology and being creative. And directly, you know, your researchers will give up. And if you seesaw them up and down, and we haven't done that. We have done it, but not as much as other people. Now, when the last thing you said there, well, we develop off of our existing products. That's what Dow's been the best at it all this time. We once get in a business, we are tough. We are tough. Also, I've always said, too, that being a good second a lot of times is better than being a first. Because there's plenty of room for innovation. And I would never let my people go into a new area like polycarbonate. Unless we offered our own technology, where we offered our part of it, not just taking somebody else's loan. That's where you start from. And that's the way you get around the patents. But that's not where you end up. You end up by contributing your share of the technology, or you ought to even be in there. And I didn't ought to reread this because it kind of sent me different directions. But Dow is trying. Okay, let me. In the day's world, the big commodity products have got it pretty rough. A lot of them have. And the fact that the Arabs and others are going to take that cheap oil and gas over there and make polyethylenes and a lot of other stuff makes pretty rough competition. So the chemical industry people in this country are scrambling to get higher value products, more diversification, which I think is essential. That's right. Well, anyway, Dow's goals, I think, today, and what they're trying to do is correct. There's no doubt about that. And I assume the way they're going at it is all right. I don't know all their details or what their plans are exactly, but there's no doubt that the president man feels like the business people should run the company. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to do things. All I say is, if they do not let the research and the manufacturing technology get too dominated by the business people. If you do, you'll lose your shirt. Do not lose your technology. It's got to have a strong voice. And we have had research and production that had a strong voice in Dow. And maybe they have to lose that a little bit because of all the government regulations and all the environmental problems and a lot of other things that the manufacturing can't go off and do their thing by themselves anymore. So And the sophistication of the products themselves demands a very close tie with all this. So that's okay. But if they will maintain a very strong R&D function in the company, where they have their say-so and where they get their input, then I think it's okay. Now, I don't know where I'm answering your question.
No, I think that's fine. I just thought I'd get your response to that. And I guess that really leads me to some of the things that you did then as research director here from between 71 and 80. There were a number of things that you did that were quite innovative. Probably your colleagues in similar positions in other countries or companies were not thinking along the lines you were. For example, you helped develop the product stewardship concept.
Yeah.
Can you?
I did develop it, yeah. Well, before that, what got me in that frame even back in when I was still in Texas, 1969, we had a big explosion in Texas, killed a lot of people. And it was because of a mix-up between a product in Midland and between Texas and the manufacturing people. And Ray Bounty, the director, and Earl Barnes, the manager, told me, I want you to create a program of some kind in Dow that will never let that happen again. We just got to have something. So I assigned that task for the company. I went to work at that and created what we call the Reactive Chemical Program. And I got a lot of people together, and we have today what we call the Reactive Chemicals Program, where we go through a lot. We've got a lot of rules and regulations about handling chemicals, and everybody who is the owner of that chemical, like a manufacturing plant or a laboratory, he's responsible to see that don't happen. And he's got to go through all these checklists and all these things, and we've got a manager of reactive chemicals in the company today who watches that. Well, when I came to Texas, I was a manager of that all the time. When I came to Texas and became director of search, I gave that to safety. And they kind of let it drop or something. And we had another rash explosion, killed some people. And Earl came to me and said, look, I want you to take that back and never turn it loose. It's yours. Okay. And I put strength back in, and we haven't had any since. And a guy named Doug Roush runs that. Then I got up here in Midland, and boy, I began to run into all these environmental concerns and worries and things, and what's going to happen to this, what's going to happen to that. So I set up the product steward system, where every product we got has got a steward assigned to it. That steward, if anything happens to anybody with that product, that steward is directly responsible for me when I was here. And if we get in trouble, that I call him on the carpet and say, okay, how come you let that happen? So every product has got a steward. And generally, you know, every product line has got several tests and deep. And generally the manager of that set of products is the steward. He sees to it that all the data's gotten, all the problems, or who's going to sell it to, what kind of, you know, everything about it. And man, that works. That works. Because they know, and I've got it all written down on a computer, who is the steward for these products. And they worry about those products. Because the minute we get in trouble, the first man I call is the steward. Come over here. Tell me what happened. And I mean, they don't like to come. So, and Doug Roush is also the director of product stewardship for the company. And we try to keep this high visibility in the company about this. Yeah, and I think a very effective system, really.
That brings up another interesting point. What was safety? What were safety considerations like in the early days in Texas when you were there, when you started?
Well, they probably weren't very good, not that good. I don't remember them being bad because I think the people in there always were pretty safety conscious. But we didn't have much program. We kept having a lot of lost time accidents, you know, and And finally, and DuPont, you know, was always so good, and Dow's record looked pretty bad. And finally, we just said to ourselves, look, we're going to stop this nonsense. That's the top management, Bartle and other people. And we just put in a program where, gosh, everybody is responsible for safety, everybody. And we're now as good as DuPont in the company. We, you know, it's been a hard sell, build up, but I don't remember it ever being real bad in Texas. But, you know, I don't think it was probably much. We'd think it's probably pretty bad today because I pull more stupid stunts myself personally, you know, that probably would have got fired today. I can remember one time when we were making these diethers. You know, you use sodium metal, and we take toluene and then put in big hunks of sodium and melt it in there, and then we start putting in the polyols to make the sodium salt of the polyols, then add some sort of methyl chloride or something to diether it. One time we me and old Bob Hefner had a 250-gallon kettle of this toluene sodium soup stirring ready to make some diethers, and the steam went off of the kettle. We couldn't get any steam, and it solidified in there. So what in the world we do? You just can't really melt that, you know? Now the steam went back on, but trying to melt through 3 or 4 feet of solid, gunked up solid sodium toluene, you know, what do we do? So we decided, well, we'll just pull it out. So we got a winch, pulled this whole big glob, about as big around as this table, you know, out, laid it on a tarp out on the deck, and started chipping it off with axes. Can you believe this? And of all things, it began to mist rain. So we got a tarp put over the top of it so it wouldn't rain on it. But we chopped enough stuff over there to get that thing back in there and get it. Just think, that could have burned us like a crisp. You know, just one flash and it had been gone. You know? And we used to get our pipes stopped up with sodium. What we do? We'd be up on top of the structure, you know, one of these pipes stopped on and the drainage ditch out. We'd just throw it out that ditch and directly it sat there a while. Oh, I tell you, more things I pulled. Can't believe it. Well, see, every one of those today, you'd probably have to go through some sort of paperwork and study before you can do any of that, you know.
I guess at the same time that you were looking at this Project Stewart, you started the CIIT, which I guess you originally dubbed the American Institute of Industrial Toxicology. And you had already established a toxicology lab here. How long had that been in existence?
Oh, a long time. Oh, yeah. See, Don Irish, his old father, they established the first tox lab in 1936, worrying about the toxicity of chemicals. Before any of all these other hot rods ever heard of it, you know. Of course, it wasn't that all sophisticated and all that good, but they had started a program. See, we celebrated 2 years ago the 50th anniversary of our tox lab. Wait a minute, it must be 34. Because it was 1984 we celebrated. So it was 34, not 36. 50 years in 84. Tox lab. And we've been the leader probably in toxicology most anybody in the world forever. You know, you can't believe. You might want to see that tox lab. That is a big place. And they are top. I'll guarantee you know they don't want well, most people don't want to trust our data. We've got the best data in the world. But anyway, reading about the CIIT, this started
I was up here and we had a lot of problems, but the one that really got to us was vinyl chloride. You know, they found these five people with carcinogens. And boy, it took off, and they accused the industry of covering up and everything under the sun. Well, none of this was true. And you see, vinyl chloride is really a safe compound. Gee, I'd almost drink vinyl chloride. I've been around vinyl chloride so much. See, well, I used to when I was, this is another part of it, we were developing vinyl chloride monomer. And my job was to determine, was it okay for polymerization? And I'd get this stuff, you know, we'd put them in these citrate bottles, or even a Coke bottle, weigh out so much, and then cap it. And if it weighed too much, we just let it vaporize out in the room, you know, till it got down to the wind, and then we'd hit it with a cap, you know. And I think a little vinyl chloride is good for you. I think it prevents cancer. I'm serious. I've told my toxicology guy that, and they think I'm crazy, but... Anyway, these people that died, what they did, they sent them down in these polymer kettles, all this slime all over them, and just saturated them with vinyl chloride, you know, and everything else, catalyst. And sure, no wonder they killed them. But in a normal exposure, vinyl chloride. But anyway, man, you know, you remember when all this hit the fan and it was terrible, and this was a very vital product to us, and I just sat and listened to that, and I got so disgusted. And I said to people, now we can't just go test everything, you know. We've got a good tox lab here, but a lot of people don't even have a tox lab, and very few do have tox labs, and we just got a limited number of toxicologists. What we need to do is join up together on this thing and create a good impartial, solid way of getting these tests done together. And I called a meeting on that, and everybody didn't think we could ever accomplish it. Just be too many legal, you know, they thought, and all kind of thing. But I said, well, just throw away all those negative ideas and let's just go do it, you know. And we did, and we've got today, I think, one of the finest toxicology, and it is really respected by environmentalists and labor and government and everybody else. And I think, well, these people say that it's the finest thing the chemical industry's ever done. And I've been real happy with all the effort everybody's put in to do this.
You called the original meeting here in what, 74?
Yeah, I called it right here in Midland. I just called up seven of my buddies, you know, at Shell and DuPont and Stauffer and Exxon, and invited them out here and presented the idea to them. And right off, I got me an outside lawyer named Milt Wessel, who is a gem. Man, this guy, he's not an average lawyer. He is something. And to sit with us to be sure we didn't do anything wrong or illegal or say anything or plot anything. And he's been with us ever since. He's still the legal counsel for CIT. Fantastic guy, unbelievable. Anyway, we pulled it off, and they were many times, several companies were doing everything in their power to block it. But when we finally swung around and got everybody convinced, then everybody piled in and did every their part. It's been a real nice, and we got so acquainted with a lot, so many of us got to know each other about the problems of the environment, that we've got a network through the chemical industry now. You know, you can just call everybody up and they know what it's all about. The little ones can go to the institute and get their answers, you know, and we're getting data fast, and they've become... Now, a lot of people thought, see, we purposely, we call it the Chemical Industry Institute of Toxicology. And people say, take out that word industry. No soap. We want people to know it's industry. But we're going to show you we can do that and build credibility at the same time. And we have. Because that thing is run independent of any chemical company. They don't have... What that board decides over there is what counts. Paul Arthas, he wouldn't have any more say-so about what happens in with Lesson, sure. But he don't have any more say-so what's happened in CIT than anybody else, you know. And they have maintained a very scientific, impartial attitude. Because my word, all the time, every meeting, we're going to build the most respected toxicology institute in the world. And it's fast becoming that. It's fast becoming that.
Were there other organizations, other places outside the United States at that time?
Not like this. Now, they formed a thing called BIPRA. I think it was BIPRA. I don't know what the initials stand for now, but in England. That had a little bit, it was completely different, but it had some of the same things about it. Because Dr. Leon Dahlberg, the guy we picked, had been associated with that or knew something about it. But the main thing was is picking the people to run it, you know. Boy, you get the wrong guys and you're whipped off. And we got our Jim and Dr. Dahlberg. I don't know whether you know him or not.
I know the name, yes.
Leon Dahlberg. Man, he was a Jim. He is a Jim. And, of course, he's got out and a fellow named Neil is running it now. But at the time, we sure needed him. He's well-versed in the area. He's a fighter. He's fights very smoothly, though. I mean, gentlemanly. And we were able to put that over. I had a lot of work.
What was the nature of the opposition you encountered at the beginning?
Well, the main competition, you need to cut your tape off.
I believe you also started, I'm not sure if I had the name correct, cooperative research, where you funded projects at large and small colleges. Were you involved in establishing that? Or
the CCR?
No, not the CCR.
Oh, you mean here at Dow?
Here at Dow, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I started back, let's see, about 70, I don't know, 6, 7, somewhere in that 6, I guess, maybe before that. So maybe like 75. Anyway, I set up a university academic section in my group staff whose job it was to try to go find out all the good stuff in the universities. And we just combed the universities hard and picked up a lot of stuff, by the way. And this was kind of the seed germination of, you know, the CCR thing, because I had a pretty poor opinion of academic people, frankly. I thought they were, particularly the chemistry departments, that they were living in the dark ages, you know? And I think some of them are, but not all of them. And we've got to help them come out of there if they're in there. And you see, back in the 30s, 20s and 30s, when old Herbert Dow and all through those, practically all the work was done in conjunction with each other. You know, they came out of the universities and they went back and worked with the universities. It was just one big happy family. And I got to watching and looking and reading that. And then I heard that they had all these big symposiums in Washington saying, you know, we're losing our lead in technology, this country. And Japanese are getting patents and we're just losing out. And then some of them would say, well, it's because university and industry is not cooperating, which probably had a lot to do with it. And then I said to myself, if that's true, then we ought to do something about it. But you can't go have a big symposium and you find the biggest name around that you can find as a speaker. You go to Washington and you have a big meeting in a big auditorium and you talk it and then you publish it and you go home. What good does that do? Nothing, practically. So I said, we're going to have a meeting where we're going to bring the parties that can do something about it together. And then we said, who are the parties? Well, we can't bite off the whole world, you know, the whole United States, but we can bite off the chemical industry. Who are the parties in the chemical industry? that can do something about this if this is a problem. And we decided the parties were the heads of the chemist and chem engineering departments and the heads of research of the chemical companies and related chemical companies. Okay? By gosh, I'll call a meeting and bring those people together.
Did you tell them what the reason was when you called the meeting?
In general terms, but what I did is a little bit maybe deceptive. I didn't mean it to be. But what I called together was a scientific... I says the way to... And I was serious. I thought the way to really get us together was to come together and talk technology together. So I had a big technology symposium. I ought to show you my first book of the program and the speeches made there. We had all kind of speeches. We had Baltimore come in and speak on biotechnology, for instance. You know, he was a Nobel Prize winner. And we had industrial people. We had academic people. And then at the end, the last day, half day, we brought the program up. Okay, have we got a problem between us? If so, what is the problem? And man, that's where it hit the fan. God darn. I tell you, it was so bad that the people, nobody trusted anybody. I was kind of unbelievable, you know? And they couldn't figure out particularly what I was up to, that I was fixing to screw them somewhere. And they actually, particularly the chemist departments, they had their own caucus off where the spokesman was going to get up and speak, you know, it was kind of interesting. But my proposal at the end was, okay, we've haggled this around and we've got a lot of things on the table, but the only way you can solve this is to have follow-through, not just come up here and waddle this around and go home, be worse than ever. So I said, I am going to appoint a task force to take what has been said at this meeting and go digest it. We're going to have a meeting a year from now with a different host, and we're going to make proposals and we're going to talk about it. And I propose that we should form some mechanism of continuing such a thing and working together. And I called it an institute or something, you know. And I didn't know sure what it ought to look like or what, but and that made some people nervous, afraid it was going to mess up their funding from industry and what they already had and stuff. In fact, this guy Gassman, you know Gassman, Paul Gassman,
Ohio State,
huh?
He was at Ohio State.
Yeah, now he's at Minnesota.
Okay.
He got so mad at that because he thought he had good that he. Told his people he wasn't going to let Dow recruit on their campus. But he was sincere. He Gassman is going to be president of CCR next year.
Really?
Anyway, that just shows what we've done. You can't believe the trust now. We can go into these annual meetings and, you know, you can do most anything and nobody raises an eyebrow. Before, you could hardly say anything. Now, what do you mean? Now, what are you fixing to do to us, you know? The only problem we haven't is penetrated deep enough into the chemistry departments. We need to figure a way to get deeper than the heads and get on down to all those professors down there. And slowly, well, I think we'll do that. But this has been about the most experiencing of... thing I've run into. It's been frustrating. I've gotten so mad sometimes at some of the professors. I tell you, some of them are pretty terrible. But I didn't appreciate the problems that the professors really have. You know, their money, their funding, and their money raising. They're all on their own. If you don't raise any money, you just don't get anywhere, you know, and that's a problem. And, you know, I've learned to appreciate a lot of things, and so has a lot of people in the industry, and so has the academic people appreciate. And boy, these meetings, you ought to attend one of them. They're great. Oh, they just love them, you know. And we make it a point to pay the professors way because we know they haven't got that kind of money in their budget. So every professor that comes, the organization, well, I paid their way the first time out of my budget. That first meeting cost me $250,000. I took it right out of my research budget. And several other industrial people asked me, well, how did you get approval from your management to spend that kind of money? I said, you want to be honest? Yeah. Well, I didn't ask them. First time Paul Orffis knew I was doing this, I came to him and I said, how about being my keynote speaker? Fine. He was.
Well, you'd probably, I have another point here. When you accepted the SRA award, you described how important it was for R&D to sell itself to top management, and you were obviously very successful in doing that.
You've just got to keep them involved. They want to be, see, most people are afraid to go probe into top management for fear. They don't want to hear me. They're not interested. But they are. They are interested. And you've got to keep them in the propaganda going, you know. For instance, you know, most people spend a month preparing for the budget for another year. They just data, and I never wasted a minute on a budget proposal for my budget. I was doing it we had what we call the happy hour at the board. Every board meeting, I had a happy hour. I went in for 30 minutes and gave a research presentation to the board. Every board meeting. And I would take anything from something where we needed to ask them for some money to the most exploratory research project out there where I'd tell them, you may never hear this again, but it sure is interesting, you know. And these speakers, men, women right off the bench, and I'd have to spend literally hours with them, training them to make a good presentation. You know, if you just take them and board, first of all, they'd probably fall dead. You know, for fright. So I would spend hours with these people and listening to them. And first time they'd come into my room, you know, shaking and reading. I said, well, now, okay, I'm going to let you read that one more time, then you're going to throw it away. Oh, I can't. Yeah, you can. You're going to speak right off the cuff. You're not going to have one note. And the time they got there, they just marveled. You can't believe what you can do with an amateur speaker. And, you know, I had the board member say, how in the world do you get all these good speakers? So I says, well, it comes pretty easy. I never did tell them what all I did. But they love that. Oh, they love that. You know, maybe one or two that doesn't, but the board in general just love. They just look forward. That's the highlight of their board meeting. You know, wrestling around with capital numbers and all that crud is boring, you know. But some good technology is.
You also commented that in that SRA address that you received the award because of the efforts of a lot of other people. Are there any people we haven't mentioned that you might want to include at this point? I mean, it's a lot. I know you've been associated with a large number, and maybe you don't want to mention any for fear of leaving some out.
Let's see. Now, I'm trying to go back what I said. Was I talking about Dow, or was... you don't know. It don't say?
Yes, I think it was your career here at Dow, and that your...
Well, I don't know as I ought to mention anybody's name in particular, but see, I think one of the finest staffs in the country. Now, I don't come now. You have to develop that. But I had some of the most cracked. I've told my people directly. I'd be in a group with all my top research directors and managers and so forth. And I'm telling you. Now, see, people don't believe this. And I'm just an old common deck, and I don't believe this a lot of time. But I tell these guys, let me tell you something. In this room is probably the finest technical managing group of people anywhere in the world. You may not appreciate that, but don't downgrade yourself, because you are, and they were. As far as I'm concerned, you couldn't beat them anywhere in the world, that group of people, what they could do. I could ask for anything under the sun, and they'd deliver it. They'd deliver it. And, of course, in some part of the field they couldn't, but in the fields we were working in. And that's the people I'm talking about. They delivered. In the 70s, we had more problems than you can shake a stick at. Energy costs, environmental problems, capital problems. You just name them, you know, we had them. And we had to deliver miracles pretty near every day to stay in business. And we did that. Well, fiddle. They get credit, but I get all the credit for everything they do, you see? And like CIIT, I get a lot of credit for CIIT, but man, just think of all the people that put all the time and effort to make that thing work. I didn't do much of I'm never the detail man, like I'm in those meetings. I don't worry about the details, because they're worrying so much about them that I'm just keeping them going, you know, keeping them getting bogged down too far in the details. And, boy, we had some gems on everything I've been in, you know, they're unbelievable talents.
I have just a few questions to finish up. What are the major changes that you've seen in the chemical industry in your career?
Well, I've got a speech on that. I'll give it to you sometime. I remember. From the time I started here, and I go through eras, but I haven't got time to do that. Let's see. Well, the main thing, the chemical industry is, of course, a maturing industry. In the years I was growing up, it was a developing industry, growing industry. And now it's still growing, but it's more in a mature state. That makes a difference. And see, when I went to work for Dow had $78 million sales. And when I quit, they had $11.5 billion sales. In fact, I had four times the research budget we had sales when I went to work for them. So I was in a real growing time with Dow Chemical Company. From here out, you won't see that kind of growth. So it's a matter of taking a more mature industry and, you know, fitting in where you can fit in and do the and all the problems facing. The big change, of course, has been all the interference from the outside in the 70s, starting with energy and environment and regulations of every sort, size, and description. See, used to, we built a pilot plant. Seemingly quick, nobody, we didn't ask nobody nothing. We went and built a pilot plant, you know? And we have a plant down in Freeport, what we call the Instant Epoxy Plant. We had to build a different kind of plant quickly. I built that plant from the day we said we were going to build it till the time we turned on the first product in 90 days. They still call it the Instant Epoxy Plant.
Imagine.
90 days. Incredible. And that plant produces 6 million pounds a year. I mean, yeah, 6 million pounds a month. big, pretty big plant. not as big as some of the bigger ones, but anyway, no way you could do that today. It'd probably take you at least a year, maybe 2 years, you know? So, regulations. I guess the other thing in the chemical industry, and particularly Dow, is because of all of this, all the legality and all the regulations and outside interference, the business people have come more and more to dominate, and I guess maybe necessity. Which I think, frankly, is bad in some ways and good in others, because Dow has always had technology-dominated companies. And I think that's fast changing if we swing it back. But you do have to honor all this other stuff. I mean, there's no way you'll be in trouble tomorrow if you don't do it, you know. Let's see, what other changes... Well, the one big change is energy cost. And if you don't adapt to that, you're out of business. And I don't guess that'll ever change. But in reality, that's probably a good thing, because we're fast trying to run out of resources in this world, and somewhere down the road, we weren't going to have any resources if we didn't start preserving them. And I think it's probably a good thing. You see, the government should have listened. There was a committee back in 1967 who predicted this about the energy, and that we should take measures to, you know, well, we shouldn't have had the depletion allowance. If we didn't have the depletion allowance, the energy would have been higher already, and people would have been saving energy way earlier, but they didn't do it. They started giving depletion allowance to keep the price of oil down, which was false economy. And therefore, people just threw it away. Gosh, they built it, including Dow. We would build a plant. Why spend the capital when you can't get your money back, you know? So I remember when I first went to Freeport, you could drive from Freeport to Houston with your headlights off because of all the gas flares between there and Houston, out of the oil wells. But boy, you don't do that, anything like that anymore, you know. Now, I noticed in those pictures of Libya, they're doing it. I saw some pictures. Did you see them where they got these big flares going, burning up all that gas?
I remember those as a kid growing up in Cleveland. We had a lot of Standard Oil, had a big plant there, and that area was always well lit at night.
Yeah, just flaring it away, yeah.
I guess my last question would be looking towards the future. What do you think is in store for the chemical industry over the next... what would a young chemist come to work
with now? I've got a speech on that. I give back on what about the 80s and beyond. That was like when I was talking 79 and 80. And I ought to find that and give it to you. I believe the opportunities... See, a lot of people think now, well, you know, the opportunities are going way down, and in a lot of respects, true. A lot of stuff has been found. All the big monomers been found, and so forth and so on. But I believe the opportunity for innovation is just as strong or stronger as it's ever been, because we've got more problems to solve, and the people who solve them are the ones who are going to win. Energy and pollution and process. I just reading about a paper process. I'll read about it. I saw it on TV. A paper process that eliminates caustic. Third of the capital, no pollution. Where they take a solvent, I think it was acetic acid and ethyl lactate or something like that, and put the pulp in there and heat it up, It all goes to fruition, then they change the temperature and it goes in two levels. And the lignin goes off, the pulp goes this way, and that's it. You know, folks, they're just constantly they're going to be. And like in process, in the 70s, there where the energy, it was just unbelievable what we could do to save energy. Just unbelievable. If we just put our minds to it. And if we hadn't, we'd have been out of business. Absolutely been out of business. And that's going to continue. And we've just got to continue to run cleaner plant, make less pollution, lower energy. Everybody is depending on this new technology. Practically every... You see, this is what CCR is doing. I consider CCR as the defender of chemical science. That's what it is. We're doing it together, university and industry. And we're not being treated fairly. The chemical industry has a terrible image. Washington is not all that hot for chemicals. They put all their money in physics and other stuff, you know. And what we've got to do is convince the people. Now, this Pimentel report, which you're aware of, is trying to do that to pretty good, I think, degree. Convince the people everything depends on chemistry. I don't care what you get into. Most of the problems are solved by chemistry. Now they apply it on in and make a resistor or integrated circuit or they do something. But the problems back there came from chemistry. And we've got to convince these people that we need more money into that area. And second, we've got to even convince the people involved in it that they've got a real future and they really need to get with it. And so many of these chemistry departments, they do live in the dark ages. They are working on some little old deal they worked on for the last 50 years, you know. Instead of risking a little bit to get out there and get involved in some new stuff. But if they once get into it, some of them they want to live a lifetime on one little old proposition, you know? You know what I'm talking about. And we've got to get a lot of these smart ones. What bothers me, and let me tell you what bothered me about, and I don't know how to solve this. Some of the best researchers out in academics are not very good money raisers. And some of the sorriest researchers are the best money raisers. Well, that's kind of true in Dow, you know. Some good talkative researcher may not be very good out here, but he gets along pretty good. And there's some kind of a oddball guy that's a dang gone good inventor, you know, he gets kind of pushed to the wayside. And I always try to find out who those are, But don't you find that to be true, what I'm saying, in industry? I mean, academic?
Oh, yes.
And it's a shame that man has to spend all his time raising money, you know? And he has to he has to do things to himself to get money that he don't have to do. And some of the most creative guys we got probably would like to spend their time doing the creation running around trying to write a contract that'll make a guy give him money, you know. And I don't know how to whip that. I haven't figured it out yet. I wished I knew how. But this is the reason that we're giving money unattached, CCR, to the departments. You put it where you want to put it. And we hope you put it on some good, creative, young guy that hasn't got any money, but he's got good ideas or something, you know. But I do think a lot of the professors have got to wake up, and we're trying to wake them up. There's an awful lot of good ones out there. So many of them, you know, they Well, they still got a pretty hard opinion of industry and profits. And like I tell them, what in the heck do you think this money you're getting? That's profits. Huh? What's the difference between you having to go out and get a contract and us having to go out and make a buck off of a product? What's the difference, you know? But some of them are still pretty hard. But we've changed a lot of them. Boy, they're cooperative dickens. They're not killing their principle. They're just being understanding and cooperative. And I've got great hopes. I think this, if we could get everybody to do this, we'd be way better off. And I just hope everybody, including industry, continues to support this, you know. Well, okay.
Do you have anything else that you'd like to add?
Probably if I could think of it. But
I guess then I'd like to thank you very much for spending this time and sharing your...
Well, I enjoyed it, yeah. Nothing I like to talk about better than is research and technology and chemical industry. And I'm on the... I'm still quite involved. I'm on the phone constantly with somebody arranging something or trying to do something. I was trying to put together with the University of Texas a deal for them, with one of the Dow people in the energy area yesterday. I'm slowly beginning to pull away. I tell you, I might end by saying I couldn't have wished for a better career. It's just absolutely fun all the way. My whole job, a whole lot to do with the people you report to. Earl Barnes was my main. I know that. But, gee, I couldn't wait to get to work. Hardly ever took any vacation. Of course, I traveled so much, I didn't need much vacation. But couldn't have had a better career myself. I enjoyed it, and I've relished in it. I think I've accomplished some things. I'm proud of them. People have been generous in saying you have. And so I look back pretty relaxed and pretty happy with my life. There's several causes and things I'd like to tackle yet, but I won't go into those right now. But I think I'm getting the point. So you've got to have a lot of resources at your hand to do some of this stuff. And if you don't have that, you just ought to get it done. And as you get older, your energy level starts dropping some, and I can't go at it like I used to. Man, I could go at it from daylight till midnight, you know.
Well, I'd like to thank you again very much for...
Well, you've been very nice, easy to talk to, right?